Now, most of you have never met me before. And when you give lectures, especially if you're a university professor, they can seem very one-dimensional. And in this particular topic that we are addressing, it is actually important that you should know just a little bit of why I am, as a mathematics professor at Oxford, also engaged in public debate with the world's leading new atheists. It goes back to my home. I come from a sectarian country, Northern Ireland, which has not always enjoyed the best reputation as an example of what Christianity means in practice. But I was very fortunate because my parents, who were evangelical Christians, were not sectarian. They allowed me, in particular, to think, and they encouraged my intellectual development. So that when I came to Cambridge, in 1962, not 1862, 1962. In my first week as a student, another student said to me, "Do you believe in God?" And then he said, "Oh, sorry, I forgot, you're Irish. You all believe in God and you fight about it." Now, of course, I'd heard that objection before. But somehow then, in that famous university, it seemed to me to be important to take it seriously. After all, my parents were Christian. So were their parents. And so, I believe, were their parents. So, of course, it was obvious that I would be a Christian, something to do with Irish genetics. And so I decided, although at that time I'd read many books, I decided that I would try to befriend people who did not share my worldview. So I looked around the class of mathematicians, and you can imagine how naive and primitive I was. I imagined in those days that anybody with a beard would probably be an atheist. Now, gentlemen, I don't want to embarrass you at all. I've since learned over the years that there are some marvelous Christians with beards. Indeed, if the truth were told, I had one for a very short time until my wife saw it. So I not only admire you, I respect you for your courage. But in any case, I talked to this man with a beard. He wasn't an atheist, but he was an agnostic. And we entered into dialogue over a period of 2 years. And after the 2 years, he became a Christian. And then for the first time I saw that people could start with one worldview and move to another worldview and become a Christian. I shared my faith in university constantly because my concern was the truth of Christianity. I was doing mathematics, which is supposed to reflect the truth of the rational structure of the universe. And so I was interested in truth. And if Christianity were not true, I was not interested in being publicly identified with it. But what I discovered was that the more I exposed my faith to opposition, the stronger it grew. Now, I pursued this interest in great detail. One of my secret loves is languages. You see the Freudian slip? It shows a deep-seated longing that needs careful psychiatric handling, I think. I have a deep-seated love for languages, because languages are communication, and I feel embarrassed in a way that I cannot address you in your language. I ought to be able to. But I did learn some, and learned to communicate in them, German in particular, and that being a lingua franca in Eastern Europe during the period of the Cold War, I spent nearly 25 years. While I was doing mathematics in Cardiff University, I traveled, particularly to the German Democratic Republic, because I was interested not only in talking to atheists, but in relating to people who'd been exposed through their education system to a worldview that was fundamentally atheistic. And then the wall fell. I helped to knock it down. Still got a bit of it at home. And because I'd been a Russian translator for many years, I decided I would then go to Siberia on a two-way ticket. And immediately, in 1989, I found myself in with the dissidents. What a fascinating time that was. And things happened then that could never happen today. I can well remember giving a mathematics seminar in one of the most famous algebra seminars in the world in Novosibirsk. And they listened politely and they asked some questions afterwards. And then they said, "We have some other questions to ask you." And I thought they were going to ask whether cows in England were green or something like that. But the first question was, "We have heard you believe in God. Why?" So I said, "You don't believe in God." "Well, of course not." "Why not?" "Well, there isn't a God." "Yeah, but that's not quite the answer to my question. Why isn't there a God?" "Well, there simply isn't a God." And then I pursued it in this mathematics seminar. And I said, "But what evidence have you got that there isn't a God?" "Evidence?" And suddenly it dawned on them. It was astonishing. And they said to me, "Do you mean to say that you have evidence for believing in God?" I said, "Of course." "Well, what is it then?" So night after night for 2 months, 3 hours at a time, I visited them in their homes while they plied me with questions. Utterly fascinating. And it was so interesting to see the effect of atheism. I remember one night I was in the home of a brilliant mathematician. And he said at the end, he said, "Everybody knows me. And except our visitor, namely me. Everybody knows that for 40 years, I've been one of the strongest atheists in this university town." And he said, "Now in my own home tonight, I hear arguments that I've never heard before and for which I've no answer." And he stopped and he turned to me and he said, "You must give me some time." I said, "Of course. Why do you need time, though?" He said, "Because I haven't even got the language and the concepts to process what you are telling me. It is so new." And anger started that they'd never been told that some of the leading scientists in the world were Christians. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can see that those days provided, all unknown to me, a certain preparation for the kind of thing in which I'm involved today. And in the past few years, I have publicly debated twice with Richard Dawkins, twice with Christopher Hitchens, and also with Michael Shermer, the editor of Skeptics magazine, and with one or two other people. Why do I do that? To win the debates? No. I'm not likely to win the debates. I do that because it seems to me to be vitally important that in the public space today, there is presented a credible alternative to the atheistic worldview, which is being promoted as the default position for any intelligent person. That's why. Let's get the debate out into the open and let the people judge. But if they're going to judge, there must be public debate. And that's why I'm so thrilled to see so many of you, because it tells me something. It tells me that you feel that this is important. Now, before I get into the details, I want to legitimize it in another way. I've talked about my own personal experience, but it's important to grasp how that experience sits within the Christian mandate. And as we read the New Testament, and particularly the historian Luke, we discover that in the book of Acts, from the beginning of Christianity, there were questions being asked in the public space. And increasingly, through that book, you find the apostles getting involved in legal trials where they've got to defend the Christian faith against misrepresentation, misunderstanding, and downright slander. That is no accident. The reason they had to defend the faith is exactly the same then as the reason we need to defend it now. And it's very simple. You cannot stand up in a complex, pluralistic society, then or now, without people misunderstanding, misrepresenting, and possibly slandering you. And therefore, you have got to be able to explain and defend the message that you believe. Now, there's a subtext in what I'm saying, and it's this. We hear often the word apologetics. It's one of the most unfortunate words in the English language because it is a transliteration and not a translation. Apologia means, as you probably know, defense. If it had been translated, instead of given a sort of philosophical sounding apologetic, then we might have realized that every Christian was involved in the early church in defending the gospel. You see, once you call a thing by a philosophical sounding name, it ends up in people's minds being treated as a little course somewhere in Philosophy 101. Ladies and gentlemen, if we learn anything this weekend, but then I don't need to tell you because my friend Stefan, I'm sure, has told you this 1,000 times in his inimitable and very able way. It is very important that the defense of the gospel we're all required to do it. Because all it is explaining what you believe in terms that people can understand and relate to, and which help clear out of their minds the false notions of that message. Listen to Paul just for a moment as he does this in the book of Acts. And this is chapter 27. Paul is in front of Agrippa, and it begins like this. Then Agrippa said to Paul, "You have permission to speak for yourself." So Paul motioned with his hand and began his apologia, his defense. Now what was it? It was not a lecture on the abstruse elements of Kant's philosophy. Although he might have had to do that on some occasions had he lived after Kant and not before him. What it was actually was a relating of his own experience of God, but told in such a way that it was credible to Agrippa, that made a very powerful impression. Because when he reached the climax of his defense, verse 24, at this point Festus interrupted Paul's defense. Notice the words repeated. "You are out of your mind, Paul." Sounds exactly like Richard Dawkins. Which is why I'm reading it to you. Because the idea that God is a delusion is nothing new. Here we have it. "You are deluded, Paul." Well, in what way? Well, he goes on to explain, because he was a brilliant psychologist, was Festus. "Your great learning is driving you insane." That is a very interesting accusation to make against a Christian. It's often the opposite, isn't it, sadly? You don't know anything at all, and that's why you're deluded. Just notice that this first accusation of being deluded was because he knew too much, not too little. "I am not insane, most excellent Festus. What I am saying is true and reasonable." Those two things. I'm not insane. Why not? Because what I'm saying is true and it is reasonable. The king is familiar with these things. He wasn't going to be interrupted, so he turns to address Agrippa again. "And I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice, because it was not done in a corner." Do you get that? The importance now of the historical locus, the historical focus. These things weren't done in a corner. "King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do." And Agrippa said to Paul, "Do you think that in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?" He was getting to the man's heart and to his conscience simultaneously as to his mind. And that's the tradition in which we stand. I don't need to tell you in Sweden, do I, that it is increasingly the case that Christians are having to defend themselves in court because of laws that are increasingly being passed in our European countries. It's not going to be very long. It has already happened in Britain. And so the book of Acts is beginning to repeat itself. I don't wish to sound melodramatic, but if you had to defend your faith in court, that would certainly get your mind working, wouldn't it? Well, it would be wise to be prepared for it. The claim that Jesus Christ is unique, the Son of God, does not sit well with pluralism. The claim that God made human beings in his own image and defines their relationship and what exactly the basic social unit of society is. I only have to say that much for you to see that conflicts with some of the major legislation that goes through our parliaments. As I say, I don't wish to be melodramatic, but we need to wake up to the fact that we need more than ever before to be able to articulate and to defend our faith. And so one of my purposes this weekend really is to encourage you. I have learned by my mistakes, and I don't come to you as some great expert at all. I floundered, and I'm the most brilliant person in the world to know what I should have said 10 minutes after I should have said it. So I've come to encourage you, not to depress you. But I think what is immensely encouraging is that this book of early church history comes to its close with that kind of scenario where Paul is defending the gospel in his own person. And it's important to mention that too. In you and in me, the gospel is on trial, is it not? So we are an apologetic, whether we want to be or not. And so it's good to think about these things. Now, I've been asked specifically to talk to you about the contemporary debate about science and God. It's a fascinating debate, and I see it in one way in a very positive light, because it is giving opportunity, certainly to me, that I have never had in my life before, but I guess from others it's the same thing. The interest is enormous. In England at the moment, coming up to Easter, we have many churches collecting in groups throughout the country and putting on a program entitled Passion for Life. And I was in London last week at St. George's Hospital in a lecture theater, a bit like this inside the hospital, but absolutely packed, standing room only, over 500 people. And it was very interesting talking to those that had done the inviting. They said this was the easiest event to invite anybody to. I said, why was that? Because everybody wants to know. Partly because of the high profile of books like The God Delusion. So in fact, one of the results of Richard Dawkins' attitude and attack on Christianity is that it has enormously raised the interest of the population in finding out what Christianity has to say. Now, in order to focus this, I want to tell you about a conference that happened in La Jolla in California a couple of years ago at the Salk Institute for Biological Sciences. It was a conference which decided that religion had to be eliminated. How was religion to be eliminated? By science. And Steven Weinberg, who opened the conference, Nobel Prize winner for physics, said that the elimination of religion might be the most important contribution that scientists could make in this generation. And you say, why? Here's a conference in a biological institute. And perhaps it's symbolic, as we'll see in a moment. It's difficult to get to the grounds of why all this fuss, but at least we can ask the principal player, Dawkins himself, what was it that got to him? And in an interview with Der Spiegel, which is a weekly magazine in Germany, he said that 9/11, the attack on the Twin Towers in New York, radicalized him. The logic of the new atheism is very simple, and for that reason it's appealing. I understand it like this. 9/11 was religion. It was a step too far, so religion must be eliminated. If you say that But that was moderate, that was extreme fanatical religion. That is true. But the answer will come back. Where does extreme religion grow? It grows on moderate religion. So moderate religion will have to go as well. How shall we do it? Well, science has already done it, but the public doesn't realize that yet. So we need to get our message across. So science has got to do the job. But then there's a third ingredient in this conference, which is extremely interesting to me, and it's this. The new atheists realize that if you eliminate religion, you create a problem for ethics. Traditionally, in the West at least, the ground of ethics, to put it simply, has been God. Now, if you remove God, you then have to find some base for ethics that's not out there, so to speak, but in here. Incidentally, the search for that base is one of the main reasons why Europe is in moral chaos increasingly. But that's a separate topic. But at this conference, they realized that there'd be an ethical vacuum if you get rid of God. So how do you replace it? And the answer came back, or the question at the conference was, what will science replace religion with? Now that's fascinating. Because you see, we're back to the situation historically like it was in the 1860s, just after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. When Thomas Henry Huxley wanted to break the power that he saw religion having in society. We call it the hegemony of religion. He wanted to replace it with the hegemony, the authority of science. So it's for science to eliminate religion, and it's for science to replace ethics. In other words, one of the subtexts in this science-religion debate today is a power struggle for authority, that is cultural authority, and who knows, maybe even political authority, but certainly cultural authority within our society. And the leaders, of whom there are four main players, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Dan Dennett, and Sam Harris, two American, two British, have published a number of best-selling books. Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion has outsold all the others, but Christopher Hitchens has published a book called God Is Not Great in English, and so on. So we've got God in the public agenda, with religion being attacked in general, but Christianity in particular. Now, it's important that I make this point tonight. I cannot speak for other religions. They have every right and would want to, of course, to speak for themselves because they have been also accused of many things. But the new atheism attacks Christianity specifically. The reasons given, well, Dawkins says that that's the religion he was familiar with from his childhood. And Christopher Hitchens almost deserves to be an honorary Irishman because he calls himself a Protestant atheist. So in any case, they tend to attack Christianity. And they attack Christianity much more than they attack God. You will notice that in my debate with Richard Dawkins, the first one, which was in America. Because when in the last few minutes I mentioned the resurrection, the change in Dawkins was profound. He said, ha, so that's what it all comes down to, Jesus. We've been having this philosophical discussion about great ideas, and now you bring it down to Jesus. How pathetic. I'll never forget his words. How unworthy of the universe. What? To talk about its creator? The one who invented light and the atom? That's pathetic, is it? Well, of course, from his perspective. But it struck me then, and it was very important that it did strike me, that it is not enough to defend God, ladies and gentlemen. It's not enough to defend God. We must not hide our Christianity, our commitment to Jesus Christ as Lord. I say that because there is enormous pressure at all levels of our society to leave the discussion at the philosophical level, but to avoid the specificity and the particularity of the Christian faith. We live in a very complex society, and we all experience this push to make our faith in God and in Christ private. If you want to believe in Jesus, that's fine, but just don't talk about it at work. You can talk about football at work, you can possibly talk about politics at work, but faith in God is private territory. And the media come piling in with the view that the default position is atheism. Our BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, has said that explicitly. We regard the default position as atheism. That means that every other position has got to justify itself, but not atheism. I want to protest against that. From that perspective, there isn't a default position. And therefore, the Christian worldview ought to be able to sit at the same table and make its case in front of the public. And we need to ensure, don't we, in ways that we can legitimately do it, to see that that happens and not just remain silent. And of course, the methodology of forcing faith into an embarrassed silence is to suggest that faith in God is unscientific and irrational. Now, I don't know about you, but I do not want to appear unscientific and irrational, particularly in my workplace, but even in other places. And that leads me to something that we need to be honest about. It's the role of fear. Fear plays a very big role in the silence of many Christians. Do you get afraid? I certainly do. And we need to be honest about it. Otherwise, we're only playing a religious game. The pressures are big enough in our society to cause grown men and women to be scared of their position, of what their colleagues might think, of what effect it might have when they come up for promotion. Because it becomes expensive to be a Christian and to be known to be a Christian. There's a famous statement in the New Testament which is often quoted at conferences like this, and I'm sure you all know it by heart, that we're always to be ready to give an answer to those, a defense to those who asked us for the reason for the hope that is within us. You all know that, don't you? What is very rarely mentioned is its context, which occurs two sentences before that. And it goes like this. Fear not their fear, But sanctify in your hearts Jesus as Lord, and so be ready. Oh, that makes it very different, doesn't it? Peter doesn't mention fear if fear wasn't real. He got scared. And everybody knew it who read the Gospels anyway. And we need to battle with our fears. The moment we try to be active and communicate rather than be silent, we will have to cope with fear. And then we shall have to sanctify, set apart, it means, Jesus as Lord. It has to do with the Lordship of Christ. They are intimately connected. The defense of the faith and our attitude as having Christ as number one, as the Lord, as the definer of my life, is central. Now again, I emphasize, I've blown it many times. And these statements of Peter ring right into the middle of my heart, as I hope they do to yours. It is a fight. It is a war. And there is nothing worse than feeling that you're on your own. Unfortunately, the problem doesn't always come from outside. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is this, that sometimes if we're not careful, our development as Christians goes at two speeds. Here we start off and we're keen Christians. Now we get a job and the job takes a lot of time and we're learning all about the job and we've become absolute brilliant experts and our Christianity stays right here. And then the moment a colleague opens his or her mouth, they detect immediately that our Christianity is not as thought through as our work. And that brings us to silence. Oh, this is very real, ladies and gentlemen. And all I can do is ask you to think yourself. There's going to have to be, if we're going to get involved in society, a redressing of the balance. And remembering that the very first commandment is to love the Lord our God with all our minds, our souls, and our strength. So that's some of the kind of atmosphere of what's going on. But you will realize that when it comes down to the relationship between science and religion, the impression given to the public is that they're at war. That science and religion, I'll just call it religion for the moment, are at war. Now, I want to argue that this is false. But it's fueled by another concept, which is not only are science and religion at war, but science in the end is the only source of truth. So science occupies the whole public space. And religion is concerned with Santa Claus, God, the Tooth Fairy, and leprechauns and goblins and ghosts. That's basically it. So science is the only way to truth. Bertrand Russell once said, "What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know." It's a wonderful phrase. And Bertrand Russell was a marvelous logician, but his logic completely left him when he made that statement. Is it too late at night for a bit of logic? Let's try. What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. Is that a statement of science? No, obviously not. Well, then you cannot know it. Because what science cannot tell us, and science cannot tell us, that what science cannot tell us, you cannot know. So if it's true, it's false. You need to watch out for things like that. In people that tell you everything that's relative, they always accept themselves. Somebody comes along to me and says, "You know, John, this is hopeless. Everything's relative." I said, "Really? Including what you just told me? That everything's relative, it's relative, so I can ignore you too." It's an overstepping of the mark. Russell's statement is logically incoherent. And it was a much more brilliant scientist, Sir Peter Medawar, who made the point. And it's very simple to see that science is limited, in that it cannot answer the questions of a child. Where have I come from? Where am I going? What is the meaning of life? The really great scientists have no difficulty seeing that science is limited. Albert Einstein very importantly pointed out that science cannot answer our ethical questions. I mean, that ought to be obvious, even if you're not Einstein. Science can tell us that if you put arsenic in your grandmother's tea, it will give her a very uncomfortable afternoon, or worse. But science cannot tell you whether you ought to do it or not in order to get your hands on her property. That has interesting reverberations in another discussion, which I'm not going to go into at the moment. So that notion of a conflict is fueled by this view that I've just mentioned, which is called scientism. Science is the only way to truth. But there are other views, and one of the most famous is that science and religion can get along wonderfully together, provided you keep them as far apart as possible. That view is called NOMA, N-O-M-A, Non-Overlapping Magisteria. It was popularized by the late Stephen Jay Gould. Sounds terrific. And it sounds terrific because it's partly true. Because there is a sense in which science, largely speaking, deals with the how questions and the why questions of function. But it doesn't deal with the why of purpose. So it's largely true. But the trouble is, it's not completely true. And if you read Gould carefully, it's claiming that science deals with reality and religion deals with everything else. Well, that's hopeless, of course. The fairies and all the rest of it. No, no. Now, how can we get a balance in this? Very easily, by looking at Scripture. Because Scripture talks about the physical universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning was the Word. All things were made by Him. It talks about the physical universe. So you can't completely separate them. There is an overlap. The Bible clearly is no textbook of science. I do not teach algebra from it in Oxford. But we must not run to the other extreme and think that Scripture has no contact with physical reality. Although we may have to think very hard about how it talks about physical reality. Now I come to my last and probably the most important point for this evening. And it's this. I want to argue with you this weekend that there is a conflict, but it's not between science and religion in the main. It is between two worldviews. And going back to the ancient Greeks, we see this very clearly. The father of the atomic theory, Democritus, brilliant man, had the idea that the universe was composed of atoms and empty space. And the atoms came pouring through empty space, so they condensed to form stars and all the rest of it. It was a brilliant idea. And from it we get the atomic theory, atomos, cannot be divided or split. Democritus believed, therefore, that the universe explained itself from the bottom up, because there is no top. There's no transcendence. There's no God. So you explain everything from the bottom up. That is the worldview that we normally call materialism. It is Richard Dawkins' worldview. Everything can be explained. In the end, in terms of matter and energy. Or putting it the other way around, everything can ultimately be reduced to matter and energy. That is, mind can be reduced to brain. Brain can be reduced to physiology. Physiology can be reduced to biology. Biology can be reduced to chemistry. Chemistry can be reduced to physics, and physics can't be reduced at all. Not even to mathematics. That is the basic idea. But Plato and Aristotle and Socrates didn't agree. They believed that there was some transcendence, God or the gods. And so coming up through history towards us, we've got these two diametrically opposed worldviews. The one side materialism and the other side theism. Now, what is our real question? Here's the key question for our weekend. Just imagine now, as I come to a finish, that this big circle is materialism. And on the other side, there's a big circle, and that's theism. And then there's a little circle in the middle, and that's science. The key question is, with which of those two worldviews does science sit most comfortably? The Dawkins argument is, science is together with materialism, with atheism. My view is the exact opposite, that science points towards God. Now, it seems almost impossible to get this across to people, that the conflict is between worldviews and not between science and faith in God. But there's an easy way to try to do it anyway. That was one of the interests of the debate in Oxford, because Dawkins and I are both scientists. So what's the difference between us? We're both passionate about science, but we have different worldviews. Let's put it up on a higher level. The Human Genome Project, its first director was Jim Watson, Nobel Prize winner, an atheist, an outspoken atheist. Its second director, now the director of the National Institute of Health in the United States, is Francis Collins, an evangelical Christian. Now, here are two top-level biologists. So what divides them is not their science, it's their worldview. Now, once we get that straight, we can then go into the problem areas and ask, what is going on here? Where does the science end and the worldview begin? How does the worldview influence the science, if at all? Is science value-free, as people tell us? Or is it, as the postmoderns would say, a social construct and of no validity as opposed to any other story? But the crucial issue is to get away from this conflict thesis, because the principal philosophers of science and historians of science in the world have all more or less rejected this conflict metaphor, as they call it. That science and religion fighting one another is not an adequate view to think of what's going on at present. Now, the moment I mention that, there will come from somewhere in the audience, so I might as well say it myself, but what about Galileo? And what about Wilberforce and Huxley? Well, what about them? If you want to hear about them, you'll have to come back tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.